You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Welcome to Carnegie. We're all here to listen to and ask questions about Gilles Doran-Saro's new review on Afghanistan. And those of you who follow Afghanistan closely will have read his previous work. And I think that we can all acknowledge that he's been one of the most prescient and wise and honest observers of the war in Afghanistan. Probably spends more time there than anyone else who's not required to be there by government service or for some other reason, and actually talks to people that many of the people who are fighting the war there don't talk to, and thus I think gives us a much more honest and broad view of what's going on. It's a particularly opportune time, obviously, to hear from Gilles from his recent trip there and some of the conversations that he's had. The administration is about to, has already launched its December review. The reports are all in from the various agencies and departments. They're going through them in the White House. They expect to have a meeting of the Principals Committee and with the President by the middle of this month. And theoretically, this review is to decide whether they need a change in strategy. I think that the verdict's already in on that. They've already decided that they're not going to have much of a change in strategy, and they talk about tweaking it. I think that this report gives us all room to pause and wonder if that, in fact, is the correct thing to do. I'll just speak briefly about Gilles. As you all know, he's a visiting scholar here at Carnegie. He told me not to read all this stuff, and just to tell you that he's an expert on Afghanistan and Turkey. He's also a professor of political science at the Sorbonne. And so what I'd like to do is have Gilles talk a bit about what's in the report, and then I will ask some questions, and then hopefully you will have some questions too, and we can have a discussion about it. Gilles.
Thanks. Well, I'm going to speak 5 to 10 minutes very quickly about a few points that I think are important to understand. Let's start with what happened in Lisbon, you know, the NATO summit in Lisbon. So from my point of view, two things are clear. First is that the Europeans will be out of Afghanistan, whatever the situation on the ground, in the next 3 years, progressively. Canadian first, Holland, Canada, then Poland, then progressively all the other ones. Still the problem with the French, the Brits, it's not very clear what they are going to do. But even if they stay in Afghanistan, it's very clear that they will try to limit their casualties. It means their military value is going to decrease very quickly. And for the Germans, they don't have a military value, so it's not a problem. The second element is that, on the contrary, the United States is now in an open-ended war. So there is no real deadline, absolutely no deadline in July 2011. I'm not even sure we'll talk about that. That's my second point. I'm not even sure that it will be a decrease. But anyway, even after 2014, it's not very clear that you will not have some U.S. fighting troops in Afghanistan. The clear consequence of that is that the cost of the war is going to be more and more American. It's the trend since 2008, but it's going to be more and more like that. The second point I think is important to notice is that the current strategy, the way it is described, is totally unrealistic. Yeah. The current strategy is twofold in a way. First, the Taliban are supposed to be weaker next year because of the military operation. And second, Karzai is going to be stronger the next few years because of the building of the Afghan National Army. From my point of view, these two points are wrong. First, the Taliban are going to be stronger next year. It's already there. It's obvious. They have made huge gains in 2010 in the north and the east. I think the big story of next year is going to be more the east than the north. Because what we have seen the last, say, 3 months, 4 months around Jalalabad is extremely worrying. And Jalalabad, of course, you know the road from Jalalabad to Kabul is a key road in Afghanistan. And the pressure is going to be much nearer to the capital, to Kabul. The north is going to deteriorate, but somehow it's not going to be a big story because it's already there. We already know that we cannot take a car from Kabul to Mazar-e-Sharif or to Kunduz if you're a foreigner, if you're working for the Afghan government, if you're working for an NGO. The last case, if you're working for an NGO, you can go maybe, but with a letter from the Taliban. So for all these reasons, I think that the Taliban have the momentum, and the trend is extremely good for them because they still have the support of the full support, the active and full support of the Pakistani military. And even if they have tactical failure, they can always come back to Pakistan, rest a little, reorganize, and go back to Afghanistan. So it leads me to my second point. The Karzai regime is going to be weaker next year. Weaker because there is, I mean, you have seen the result of the last legislative election in Afghanistan. We are clearly, what I said already last year, in a post-democratic Afghanistan. Karzai is more and more isolated. And the state structure is progressively disappearing at the district level. It's done in the north, it's done in the east, it's obvious in the south. So you don't have a functioning state in Afghanistan. I don't see how you can build an army outside a larger structure of the state. It's not possible to have an army built outside everything. Standing alone army. I don't think it's possible. You need a structure, you need a political legitimacy, you need all that, and it's not anywhere possible in the next 2 or 3 years. So we are putting a lot of money in the training of the Afghan army. It's good in a way for other reasons. We'll maybe answer that in the question. But it's not going to basically stop the Taliban. What we can have, the best situation, would be an Afghan national army able to defend a few cities and a few key roads. But if the idea is to be sure that Al-Qaeda is not back in Afghanistan, of course it's not going to work, because the Afghan national army will never be able to control the border areas towards Pakistan. It's clear. So the idea that you can progressively withdraw from Afghanistan, letting the Afghan National Army do the work, is just not coherent if you think that the main strategic interest of the United States is to avoid Al-Qaeda back in Afghanistan. In case Al-Qaeda wants to be back in Afghanistan, I am not sure at all of that. But anyway, if you think that, the current strategy is not working. It cannot work. So that's the 2 points. Now, we've bet everything on the operation in 2 provinces, Kandahar and Helmand, in the south of Afghanistan. The reason why the US military have chosen to put their main effort in these 2 provinces is difficult to explain in rational terms. It's mostly the sunk cost trap, if you want. It's mostly because the British were fighting in Helmand that the US military decided that it was important to win there, just not to give some ground to the Taliban. In the case of Kandahar, it's probably the worst place where you should try to fight the Taliban. Because they are popular, they are seriously popular. And second, there is no Afghan state. There are just a few corrupt officials without any social backing. So deciding to fight the Taliban here means you need a solid political strategy, and we don't have a solid political strategy because there is nobody to work with. And third element, it's the place where the Pakistani support is the most efficient. From Kandahar to the border, it's 2 hours by car. Okay, 3 hours. The main social and political base of the Taliban is not in the north, near Peshawar or the Fatah, it's in Quetta. Quetta, from Quetta to the border. So, to choose the fight the Taliban there, I think, was not a good idea. What's going on the ground is proving that every day. There is no progress on the ground in the sense that even if the U.S. military is able to clear some areas, and I'm not sure of that in the long term, but even if everything goes well on the military ground, military point of view, you don't have anybody to put in these places to admit to a civil servant, for example, to help the population, to have a development program, to have an Afghan state. There is nothing. And what we are going to see is a kind of stalemate in the south. The Taliban will still be here. They are part of the population. They have a support. And the foreign forces trying to find somebody to talk with, which is more and more complicated in Kandahar, because the Taliban, they have their own counter-insurgency program. And it's a very simple one. They kill everybody who is speaking with the foreigners, or even who could speak to the foreigners. It's efficient, it's radical, and it's working very well so far. So for all these reasons, I don't want to be too long, for all these reasons, what's going to happen next year is quite clear. Less Europeans, more Taliban, and Karzai not able to do the work. So the logical consequence of that, if I'm not wrong, is that the United States will need to put more resources in Afghanistan. That's called an escalation. And we are, since the beginning, in a way, in this clear trend. Every year since 2002, we put more troops and more resources in Afghanistan. Total cost is going to be well over $1 trillion, well over, until 2014. And, of course, 2014 is not the end of the war. It's just the minimum you can think of now. And there is no solution, of course. And the cost, in a strategic term, is going to be huge. Because, of course, Afghanistan is producing more militants, more radical militants, more jihadist groups. It's the perfect playground for these people to fight, to learn how to fight. So I'm not very optimistic, and maybe we'll address that. Yeah, you've understood the point, yeah. I tend to make the point again, because I'm not sure you understand always what I'm saying in English, so you know I tend to be kind of little heavy, but I think you got the main idea. And the thing is that the situation on the ground is in a way not very difficult to understand. So it was very nice of you to say, I was not very wise, I'm not that clever, even if I'm a French academic. I am saying basically what everybody is saying. It's not very, I'm sorry, I should not say that, but it's not very original what I'm saying. You go to Kabul and everybody's saying the same thing. So the prime is not in Kabul, the prime is in Washington somewhere. And here we have the timing, the political timing of Washington politics. And it seems to be extremely difficult to go somewhere in the next 18 months or 2 years. That's why I'm very pessimistic. Thank you.
Thank you. One of the things that you emphasize in the report is the need to quickly move toward political negotiations with the Taliban. And yet, as I read and listen to you, you've described them as very much in a winning situation. And I guess my question is, why would they want to negotiate now? What advantages would there be for them? And also, it seems to me from what we hear and what we read that the position of the United States, at least, and certainly of the Europeans even more so, is yes to negotiate. And in fact, they are pushing for that and do see it as an exit strategy.
Well, Maybe first point, why negotiate now and not wait a few months? Because that's, Petro's advisors are making the point very often that the idea is you change the balance of power, you negotiate from a situation of strength. It's not going to work because the situation is going to be worse next year. So if you want to negotiate, better to negotiate now than in 6 months or 1 year because the situation is going to be worse. Maybe the Taliban leadership is going to lose control of a certain amount of commander on the ground. That's a possibility. It's not my feeling, but some very knowledgeable people are thinking that right now, the operations in Kandahar actually are destructuring the Taliban. And they are pushing a new generation, the guys are 25 years old, who are much more radical than the traditional Shura in Quetta. So here is a real danger. I don't think that the current operation in the south is helping to a negotiation. I think it's decreasing the probability of a negotiation. The second thing is that I'm not sure it's going to work, but I don't see anything else practical, basically. So there are very good arguments pro and con. I will give you a few arguments pro. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't see what is wrong with trying. The only real cost of negotiating with the Taliban are in Washington. It's public opinion, it's the Republican, it's that. It's not on the ground, it's not in Afghanistan. It's not going to be worse because you try to speak with the Taliban. And the third point now is, why should they say yes, no, or maybe? First, we have a clear indication that part of the leadership wants to negotiate. That's off the record, so I cannot give more detail, but there are real signs. It seems that very high-level Taliban are trying to contact directly the Americans, and they want some kind of negotiation. That's the first argument. So you can argue maybe it's wrong, but there is something here. The second point is that don't forget that the Taliban leadership is under the control of the Pakistani military, and the Pakistani military wants a negotiation. That's clear. They want a well-organized exit of the Western forces from Afghanistan. They don't want a panic. They don't want a humiliation of the coalition and a kind of Vietnam-like or Soviet-like exit. They want something organized, and they want to negotiate. So that's the main argument. Some people would say that it's not possible, that the Taliban are too close to Al-Qaeda, for example, to negotiate. I don't think so. There is a book that is going to be published in a few months by Hearst Publisher, which is describing the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And for me, it's what I've already thought, but in a less articulated way. The relationship is not that close. We have a real opportunity. There is a window of opportunity. We can do it in the next year, in the next 12 months.
But are you saying that the U.S. position, the current position, which is that negotiations have to be Afghan-led, this has to be run by the Afghan government, that they should just abandon that and try to negotiate directly?
But I mean, let's be Taliban for 2 minutes. Would you like to negotiate? Yes, okay, it's a little bit. But would you try to negotiate with Karzai? When you want to negotiate with your enemies, basically. You want to negotiate with the people who are influential. We have the money, the gun. Karzai has nothing of that. So why should the Taliban put part of their credibility in negotiation with Karzai when Karzai has no power and when you don't know what the coalition is going to say about this negotiation? It's a risk that, as a Taliban, I would not take. Plus, for the Pakistani army, the civilians in Pakistan are not part of the picture. For the Pakistani army, it's very important to have negotiation with the United States because it's a way to recognize the role of Pakistan. Negotiating with Karzai is what? It's negotiating with the guy who is part of a part of the Kabul city. There's no way. No way.
What about the, you know, there increasingly in Afghanistan are non-Pashtun, non-Taliban figures who very much do not want a negotiation and have begun to seek out their own allies in those countries in the neighborhood that are similarly opposed to any kind of a power-sharing deal, the Russians, the Iranians, the Indians. How does the United States as a policy matter negotiate that, and how do they keep those forces, the former Northern Alliance forces largely, from rearming and pushing the country back into civil war with some support from other countries in the neighborhood?
So 2 points. First, what's the scenario that people are working on? The idea is, and it was suggested by the former U.S. ambassador in India, if I'm not wrong. The idea is basically that you can work with northern people. It's Northern Alliance doesn't exist anymore, but let's say northern political forces. And so you divide the country in two, basically. So north of Kabul, or north of the Salang Pass, you will have people working with the United States, Uzbek, Tajik, different ethnicities. And these people will accept the presence of foreign bases, of coalition bases. And the South will be, the East and the South will be de facto Taliban land. So I see at least, there are plenty of problems with this scenario, but at least two problems. First, you say that you put the Taliban in the position of not only being the jihadist, I mean, and it's a positive term, the representative of the jihad in Afghanistan, but also the only representative of the Afghan unity. So basically, you're giving the Taliban everything. Everything. I mean, politically, it's a disaster inside Afghanistan. And I'm not sure that even Karzai would work with that. I mean, it's politically suicidal because Afghan people, they have a strong, okay, they fight each other, but they have the strong sense of identity as Afghan, you know. And I've seen that a lot, you know. Maybe they are Pashtun, maybe they are Tajik, but they are Afghan. And they prefer to fight each other in the same country. So, so to speak. Well, the second point is that this scenario is deeply stupid. Where is the security problem of the United States? It's in the Pashtun areas. Let's say from Indus to the Hazarajat. All this area. You take the Afghan-Pakistani border, and you take 200 kilometers both sides, and you have really the problem is somewhere here. Okay, and now you're suggesting to leave this area to the Taliban or, let's say, jihadist group, and to focus all your forces in the north, where, of course, there is no problem. What exactly are you going to do with that? It's nowhere, I mean. So if Al-Qaeda wants to come back in this area, they will. Why? Because the Taliban will not be in charge of a state. It's not going to be a state. It's going to be a de facto situation. And you're losing control of everything. And the third argument is that it would have a very destabilizing effect on Pakistan. Because basically saying that, you're redrawing the map. So what about a big Balochistan in the south, a big Pashtunistan from Indus to the Hazarajat, and so on and so on. So honestly, I don't think it can even work remotely. That's the first point. The second point, to answer your question, is, are people trying to do that? Is it going to work? First, yes, some people are doing that. The former intelligence chief, Saleh, is trying to do something like that. So he's asking money to the Indians, to the Western countries, and he's trying to build something in the north. So some people are thinking about that. I think the Iranians are more subtle than that. They are helping a little Karzai, a little the Taliban. They are trying to stay out of trouble. I don't think they will work with that. But yes, some people are doing. Is it going to work? No. Why? Because there is nobody in the north. The north is not a place where you can have the emergence of a strong military player or political player. The North is more and more divided, fragmented politically. That's why the Taliban are making progress the way they are making progress, because there is nothing. There is nothing. The local strongmen in the North, they control Alpha Valley, a few villages. It's nothing. It's a very low-key military player. So nobody is going to resist the Taliban. So it's not doable, but just speaking of it is dangerous. That would be my basic answer.
There were some suggestions before the presidential election in Afghanistan last year that the United States and the Western allies there should push to jettison the political system that they put in place in Afghanistan in late 2001, that in fact this constitutional system, strong centralized government, powerful presidency, doesn't work there, and that there should be some kind of new jirga system, and they should try to get these groups together in a way that would result in a de facto power-sharing system. That seems to have gone away with the presidential election, and the Americans at least seem to have kind of put all their eggs in the Karzai basket, even realizing that was a pretty bad option. Should there be another push? Is one way to go at this to once again try to establish a different kind of government in Afghanistan, or has the situation gone so far beyond that's just not a viable option now?
Okay. First point, the key weakness of the political system, political framework, institutional framework in Afghanistan was not presidential, was the lack of political parties. That's the key problem in Afghanistan. And thanks to the experts of the UN, there was no pressure in 2002 to build a strong political party system in Afghanistan. Basically, think Germany. Germany should have been the model. You need political parties. Why? Because you're in a place that's extremely fragmented. So you need political party to aggregate the demands, to be the go-between, the population and the state, the institutions. And there is no political party in Afghanistan, except the Taliban. But it's another problem. So that was the key problem. The problem was not what kind of system. The second element of response, of answer, is Karzai has been one of the key elements in the quick weakening of the Afghan state because he was appointing province governors who were extremely, extremely unqualified. And that was one of the key problems in Afghanistan. Again and again, it was the same guys. A guy was 6 months somewhere. He was almost by himself starting a civil war. And the Karzai answer was to put him in another province. So just to be sure on that. That's one of the key problems. Not in itself the fact that the system is presidential or not presidential. So the problem was Karzai, his personality, the way he's working, much more than something else. The third element of response is that all that doesn't matter anyway. The new parliament doesn't matter. When people are speaking about a jirga, it's just a way to go around the parliament. And the last parliament was, in a way, not so bad compared with the one we are going to have now. And so the jirga is just a way for Karzai to put his men in case of the parliament is not responding the way he wants. So the jirga are not a solution. And the last element of response is that the negotiation process must be a way to put that on the table, to find a new leader, because part of the negotiation process is who is going to be in power in Kabul. And then we have to get rid of Karzai, send him to Dubai. He has enough money, it seems. Do something with the people representative to a certain extent of the North, Rachid Dostum is not acceptable because he has killed too many people, he's raped too many people. But a leader from the Jumbesh, the party is more or less in control of, could be part of the negotiation. People from the Panjshir must be part of the negotiation. People from Badakhshan, and so on and so on. People from Azerbaijan also. Then you can have a negotiation of what kind of state you want. It should be on the table because the idea that the Taliban are just going to give their weapon and just respect the current constitution is just not workable.
I think I wanted to ask you just a little bit about your analysis of what's happening in this country. You seem to posit only kind of two alternatives. One is a major withdrawal next summer versus the need for the beginning of an escalation. After Lisbon, I kind of saw it in a somewhat different way, that de facto the United States and with strong support from the Europeans, has already decided on the kind of phased withdrawal that you've said has to happen, that there'll be a largely cosmetic withdrawal starting in July, and that by setting this 2014 date, they pretty much have committed themselves to a gradual withdrawal. I don't see any support for escalation at all. And I wonder if what you're proposing is in fact what's happening now, although no one's going to say it. And the fly in the ointment, obviously, is General Petraeus, who I think has very different ideas about what should happen there. And the question, the political question here becomes whether the administration, there are going to be loud enough voices inside that will say, no, this is not working.
I'm sure that... I mean, for the Europeans, we totally agree. I'm sure that in the White House, most probably, they are seeing the disaster coming. It's not reasonable to put $1 trillion in Afghanistan, which is not a place where you have very, very important national interest when you're trying to cut the social security because you want to balance the budget. I mean, it doesn't make sense. So, from the White House perspective, I think the people are kind of very skeptical about the current strategy. At the same time, in this country, it's difficult to get something from the military if they don't want to give it. That's what happened to Obama last year when he wanted alternatives. He wanted plan A, plan B, plan C. And actually, he just had one plan, plan A. Send 30,000 or 40,000 men in Afghanistan. So there is a problem, a deep problem of relationship between the political power and the military power in this country. I think that the rationality of the U.S. military is that they don't want to lose. So they are just asking more resources and more resources and more resources. That's the key problem. And the political power, I mean the civilian power, has to say we stop because it's not rational to send that level of resources in this country. That's one thing. Second thing, yes, that's what they think they are doing in Lisbon. But at the same time, if next year the Taliban are much stronger than this year, if they gain ground to a point where they're attacking every day the base, bombing every day, rocketing every day the base in Jalalabad, or even in Bagram near Kabul, what are we doing to do? Now the Taliban are extremely close to Kabul. What are we going to do if they take a little city like Ghazni or other cities? What's the answer to that? You cannot say just say, okay, it's not a problem, we are going to withdraw troops in 2012, because the military situation is going to be a disaster. That's my problem. And the best troops are stuck in the south. So if you have an emergency problem in the east or the north, what are you going to do? That's why I think, yes, the Europeans and the White House, they want to withdraw, that they are very clear about that. Yes, at the same time, they put themselves in a situation where they could be obliged to send more troops just to contain the Taliban. And the missing piece since the beginning is that you cannot withdraw from Afghanistan without a political deal. that's not very complicated. You cannot withdraw without a political deal.
Questions? Do you have a microphone? And can you just identify yourselves and your affiliation? Yes, sir.
Yeah, good morning. I'm Bob Dreyfus with The Nation magazine. If what you're saying about the Taliban being under Pakistan control, and I know you've said earlier in other papers that they have a modicum of independence if they ever took power in Afghanistan, but in any case, what does Pakistan want? In other words, shouldn't the address for the United States, if we want a political settlement, be in Pakistan? And if so, what could President Obama say to Pakistan to get them to underwrite a deal? And then what would India's response be? Wouldn't we have to get India to basically also underwrite that deal?
Okay. The first thing is that you have two U.S. policies that are not working well together. One is the containment of China. I know technically it's not exactly a containment, but the idea basically that you're playing India against China. That's why the United States made a nuclear agreement with India that was basically giving everything. It was basically written by India. That's why during the last Obama trip in New Delhi, you had this clever move to good relationship with India. And at the same time, if you think Pakistan, Afghanistan, all these moves are a clear disaster. So today we are in a position where there is, of course, no trust. I'm not speaking only about WikiLeaks, but it's part of what we learn. I mean, the level of distrust, that's what we were saying of the record, but now it's on the record. Nobody trusts nobody. The Pakistan army is not going to give one inch to the U.S. military and the U.S. government about the support to the Taliban. It's there. It's going to stay there. So how do you deal with these two different policies? One is pro-India, one is the war in Afghanistan and the need of some kind of Pakistani support. The only way is to go out, and to go out, we need Pakistani support. And there, instead of trying to educate the Pakistani leadership, we can have a real discussion about common interest. We want out, because it's too costly to stay. $120 billion a year just for the United States, it's not reasonable. The Pakistani military wants us out, so far so good. And now we can have a discussion. What do the Pakistani want? First, they want the Indians out. That's the only thing. They're obsessed by India. It's not rational. It's whatever you want, but it's like that. You cannot change anything. And the idea that we can do something about Kashmir is just not going to work. Yeah. So we have to deal with the reality. The reality is they want India out. But at the same time, where there is something to negotiate, it's not about the presence of India in Afghanistan. Maybe we can say, okay, the Indians should go more or less out of Afghanistan. The problem is Lashkar-e-Taiba or the jihadist group been able to strike India from Afghanistan? That's the real discussion. Because India can live without a strong presence in Afghanistan. India cannot live with jihadist group working against its very legitimate interest from Afghanistan. And then you see that there is probably a common interest here. We, as Western countries, do not want Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. The Indians do not want Lashkar-e-Taiba or jihadist group. At the same time, I think it's negotiable for Pakistan. Pakistan has trouble to control these groups. Al-Qaeda, they never control Al-Qaeda, and Lashkar-e-Taiba is largely out of control now. So probably that's the point where you can make a deal. Saying, okay, we go out, India is basically out of the picture in Afghanistan, but at the same time, we must be sure that there is no threat coming from Afghanistan. That's the general idea of the negotiation. Yeah. At the same time, the second answer, I would say, is to say that Pakistan is dreaming. I mean, it's wishful thinking when they think that they are going to control Afghanistan. They will not control Afghanistan. But to start the negotiation, you cannot say that to the Pakistanis, basically. But the long term, what's going to happen is you will have people in Afghanistan working Afghan for Afghan interest, the way they understand it, and not Pakistani interest. But that's something else.
Yes.
Wait, Manawar with Zurich Partners. It appears that there's a lot of conflating notions here. The Afghan people despise the Taliban. The Taliban has no base except in some part of Afghanistan. It appears also that based on the meeting we had last week with Senators Lieberman and McCain, that General Petraeus is doing a great job in Kandahar, especially in Andargab district.
Andargab. Yeah.
And it appears also that during these operations, there has been a few ISI operatives that have been captured in Helmand and in Kandahar, but it has not been revealed. So why should the Afghan people first negotiate with ISI if the Taliban are not a political movement? That's my first question. Second, what would be your recommendation for White House vis-a-vis Pakistan policy? It appears that Pakistan has been getting away with murdering a lot of Americans in Afghanistan. Thank you.
For the first point, I mean, if they just capture a few ISI operatives, but they are not very efficient because you probably can get a lot of more than that. And we should not speak about ISI as a kind of separate entity. ISI is the Pakistani army. So I think it's a dream. And of course, the Pakistani played with that. Oh, you know, people are independent inside ISI. It's not true, basically. The ISI is just part of the military. So, yes, the military is supporting the Taliban in Kandahar. Yes. Second thing, no, it's not going great. It's a real deep disaster, especially in Argandab, Panjwe, Zari, all that is a disaster. So what's happening right now is that you have a media offensive, something like that from Petraeus and his staff to explain that everything is great in Kandahar. All the sources, independent sources I have from Kandahar, everybody's saying the same thing, it's a disaster. Disaster for different, first, Argandab. You know what happened in Argandab? Basically, the US troops surrounded the place, the district, and then they sent Amadou Ali Karzai militia inside the district of Argandab. And the place was closed to journalists for 2 weeks. And we know what's happening in this sort of situation. And no, it's not going to work because when you clean up Argandab or Panjwe, places where the Taliban have very deep support now, especially Panjwe, what are you doing after? You just keep the soldiers here because they cannot move. If they move, the Taliban are back. You cannot put Afghan civil servants because there is nobody you can trust. Everybody hates Karzai in Kandahar, except the people who are working directly with him and make a lot of money with him. So no, Kandahar is going nowhere. Nowhere. You cannot break the back of the Taliban in Kandahar. It doesn't make sense. Yeah. Because people who are killed in Kandahar, the Taliban who are killed in Kandahar, are low-key people. The important people are in Quetta. Yeah. So that's the problem. And we should be clear about what's happening in Kandahar and in Helmand. Because in 6 months, it's going to be back to us with a vengeance. I mean, it's bad. It's really bad. So that's the first part of my answer. The second part is about what should we do with Pakistan. First, we should accept Pakistan the way it is. We should renounce definitively the idea that everything in the world can be just a matter of carrots and stick. This vision of the world is just self-destructing, you know. No, Pakistan has their own interests, their own perception. We could agree that their perception of India is just a little crazy, but it's the way it is. If we negotiate with Pakistan, we negotiate on common interest. We cannot shape Pakistan the way that we cannot shape Iran. This country has their own dynamics, and it's a reality. Means what? Means find common interest, stop funding the Pakistani army the way we are doing, and get some common interest, which is to say, exit Afghanistan in a way that is relatively convenient for us and convenient for the Pakistanis. The idea that you send billions of dollars funding Pakistan, a place that is so corrupt, I mean, it's even by any standard, Pakistan has a real problem of corruption. Its elites are totally corrupt. Sending billions of dollars there with an impact that is at the best limited, and at the same time having the Pakistanis supporting the insurgents who are killing American soldiers doesn't make sense. Absolutely doesn't make sense. That's why we have to withdraw from Afghanistan. Because then you can have a real Pakistani policy that makes sense.
Yes, sir. Someone tell me what time it is. I'm sorry. I promised to give you. 10:20. Okay, thank you.
Dennis Cooks at the Woodrow Wilson Center. I have two questions. I wonder if you'd comment on the Durand line and whether this is a notional problem or whether it's a real problem between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the second has to do with the electoral system that they use in choosing the parliament. I understood that this was a cockamamie system that was thought up for the earlier parliamentary election, and I think there's only one other country in the world that uses it, a South Pacific island. And I wonder whether this really poses a problem in the election of the parliament, in addition to the point you made about political parties, which is a real problem. And I guess it has historical roots in Afghanistan because they're seen as bad. What would it take to change the parliamentary electoral system? And also, what would it take to get Karzai to accept political parties? Sorry for the convoluted nature of this.
It's okay. I will manage. On the Durand line, you all know that Afghanistan never recognized the Durand line as an international border. Never.
Three times they recognized.
Yeah, but after they change, so, I mean, at the end, they recognize it. Never, I mean, never, talk later, but it's never been, Daoud basically refused to recognize
it.
Never accepted. I mean, it's recognized concretely as a border because you have border posts and everything. Well, I mean, we could discuss about that, but speak to any Afghan, they say no. So that's part of the problem, yes. At the same time, could we make that part of the discussion right now? I'm a little bit skeptical. I think it's going too deep. It's exactly the kind of... even the Taliban never recognized the border, really. So it's too complicated. It's too hot. In Afghanistan, it's an extremely hot issue. So no. I don't think we should talk about it, as part of the discussion. The second thing is that you have what I would call a transnational space now, means very low level of state control of both sides of the border and very huge exchanges, goods, political parties are moving, armed militants, of course. Everybody is moving. So it's a transnational space. That's very interesting. Very autonomous transnational space. At the same time, political parties are Afghan or Pakistanis. They are not both. So far, the border is still here as a political, the political meaning. Yeah. The real problem, and that's why I was thinking when I was describing the scenario of the dividing Afghanistan north and south, the problem that could be terrible if you have the emergence of a transnational political party in the name of Pashtunistan or whatever, that would be the end of Pakistan, basically. Yeah. if the movement was strong enough. So far, the good news is that the Taliban want to go to Kabul, and the jihadist group in Pakistan are targeting mostly Islamabad. That's not exactly very good news, but the worst would be to have a movement that is fighting to for a new country or to redraw the borders. That would be much worse. Yeah. The second element is that the key problem of the election in Afghanistan is that you can have, it's one round. You can have 20, 30 candidates in Kabul or other places. And just the guy who's elected can have 8% of the votes. That's madness. That's madness. And the main responsibility of this mad system is with the foreign advisors in 2002. Why? Because you had this huge problem in Afghanistan, what they call the Tanzim, political parties had a very bad reputation because they were part of the civil war in the 90s. So we understand that. At the same time, if you just say, okay, everybody is able to compete in the election, you have 30 people and the guy who's elected is not representative. What's happening in Ghazni province, for example? The Hazara were united, the Pashtun were not united, the Hazara were elected, basically, they are less than 50% of the population, and all the representatives are Hazara. So the good thing would have been to say, first, you have two rounds. It's a French-style election. For first, everybody can go, and the second, just the... And the second thing should have, the candidacy should have restricted to people belonging to political parties, to strong national political parties. We forgot the parties, and we forgot that people in Afghanistan are rational. So when you put a lot of rational people together without rules, it's a mess. That's exactly what's happening in Afghanistan. Yeah. And by the way, it's no time to reform all that because people just cannot vote. So they are under Taliban control. So.
Jessica Matthews at Carnegie. Two questions. One is, you've used Taliban throughout. Are we now, are Afghan and Pakistani Taliban now united enough that we can do that, or are there remaining divisions? But secondly, I agree with you that the strength and the weakness of the U.S. military is the determination to win. But if there is one person in the United States military that you would think understands fully the political component of where he is and what he's doing, it's Petraeus. So I wonder, and he's getting presumably daily briefings on the situation as you're getting from your contacts on the ground. So explain to us what he's thinking. I mean, he's smart. Right, he is not blind about the trend on the ground. I find it hard to believe that it is as mindless as one has to assume from what you've said.
Yeah. Well, let's start for the first question. For now, there is collaboration, tactical collaboration between the Taliban and the Pakistani jihadist groups, because they are bombed by the same people. So I mean, but at the same time, the Taliban are supported by the Pakistani army, and they know that there is a red line. So they should not attack the Pakistani army. So it's clear that they are. Remember the Kurds. For example, it's exactly the same kind of situation. You need the support of one state to fight another one. You cannot fight both ways. Yeah. So they are not going to attack the Pakistan state. They are quite reasonable. They are doing what they have to do in Pakistan, but that's it. So they are not interfering. There is one exception to a certain extent in a few Waziristan, South North Waziristan, places like that, where there is more connection between Haqqani and what's called the Arabs or whatever. But if you start negotiating and Haqqani is saying, okay, I don't want to be part of negotiation, you have won a decisive victory. The Taliban movement is broken. It's huge. It's a huge victory. So whatever the situation, it's good to negotiate. If Haqqani is saying, okay, I'm going to obey to Mullah Omar, it's the big price, because you could have a relatively stable border. If he refuses to be part of the Taliban, you have two different insurgencies. That's good. All that is good. I mean, whatever the result, it's good. Yeah. And the relationship with Al-Qaeda basically is not a huge problem. The Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, don't have a huge connection with Al-Qaeda. That's not the problem. What could be the problem is an overreaction if some guy with an Afghan passport is trying to do something crazy in an airport or whatever. Even if the guy spent all his life in Pakistan, he has an Afghan passport, and then you will have all this huge overreaction of the media and the political system in the United States. That could be a huge problem. But, well, let's hope that's not going to be like that. Second point. That would be my answer. I do not understand at all what is the Petraeus logic, because the description on the ground is extremely clear. You cannot win against an insurgency with full support of the neighboring state. Nobody has, I don't think there is one example in military history. Yeah. And you can go to the French war in Algeria. Militarily, the French won the war. But first, it was supposed to be French territory. There was a huge state structure there. The war was extremely violent. You know, hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And the border were closed. What's called the Plan Châle plan was, they closed the border. It's huge. You have to see what. And with that, after a few years of intense fight, the French army was able more or less to win military on the ground. And it was a huge investment. Okay, we are not going to seal the Afghan-Pakistani border for obvious reasons. So in military terms, there is no way out. You're not going to break the Taliban in little pieces. You're not going to win military against them. So the only possibility I see right now is that Petraeus is thinking that next year, with a few tactical success, he will be able to support the negotiation. He doesn't want negotiation now because he thinks that in 6 months, he will be in a better position. And I think he's seriously wrong about that. We are going to see that next spring. But saying that, I'm just guessing. At the same time, Petraeus is saying to everybody, especially his European counterparts, that the situation is very good on the ground, they are making progress, and so on. But I don't see it.
I think there's to answer your question, there's a good line in your paper, which talks about this, that the military is a bureaucratic machine oriented toward its own management, not toward problem solving. And then you say those in charge still define success in terms of inputs and outputs rather than outcomes. And I think when you listen to the military people, you hear that all the time. They're always talking about inputs. We finally have the inputs. And then they start to use metrics to define the outputs, which are number of people killed, number of streets cleared, but those don't really speak to the outcome. They don't really speak to a transformation in any kind of permanent way to the situation on the ground. Is that exactly that? I think we have.
I mean, the interesting thing is that Petraeus ought to understand that. He's not an unknown quantity on this.
Well, I think Gilles may be right. He may understand. I mean, he may just have a different sense of timing about when the political situation should start. I think we have time for one more question. Yeah, back there.
Discuss about that later.
Clay Ramsey, Program on International Policy Attitudes, and I'm actually going to reprise Jessica Matthews' question. I agree that I think you're drawing this in bold strokes that put you in a place where you need to develop a psychological account of the American military leadership on the ground. And so, taking another tack at it, if we think of, recall that Petraeus is a PhD in counterinsurgency surrounded by advisors who are also PhDs in counterinsurgency, to the degree that they are, in addition to practitioners, they're theoreticians. And they are aware of themselves as making a contribution to military science. And so I'm suggesting, might this be an Achilles heel on their part, that if you look at the more rarefied level of their thinking, there's something they're doing that is producing this these blockages in their perception of what's going on the ground.
What you're telling me is that basically academics are in charge of the war, and you think that he's going to war. No, the thing that they have PhDs is certainly very good, but as an academic, I'm not totally convinced. Joke apart. What was very interesting is that when Petraeus came in Afghanistan, he just buried a McChrystal strategy in 2 weeks. That's a key point, is that we are no more in a counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan, just for you to know, in case you missed the point. It's a very different strategy. It's extremely violent. Actually, the level of operation right now in the south is much at a higher level than in Iraq during the surge. Bombing, night raids, and so on. So clearly, he wants to. He has a purely military strategy. It's not at all what he did in Iraq, of course. But I cannot understand exactly why. What I can do is describe what he's doing. There is no political strategy in Kandahar. There is no political strategy. Nobody can describe what he wants to do politically in Kandahar. Because in June, it was clear that nothing was going to move with Ahmad Wali Karzai. No, there was no idea of reforming the local administration. Helmand, from this point of view, is a mess. So if something is done, it's through the U.S. military. It's not locally done. So there is no state structure rebuild in the south. So there is no political strategy. And you cannot talk with notable. If they talk to you, they are dead very quickly. So I'm just seeing that you have a strictly military perspective, killing as many Taliban as possible the quickest way. You have still the fact that the Taliban have a sanctuary in Pakistan. You have a general deterioration of the situation in all the country. And it's interesting because Petraeus was in Paris 2 weeks ago. And there was a question about the operation in the north. And he said, okay, but you know, actually, the Taliban are just putting pressure in the north just for us to lose our focus in the south. Which was an interesting answer. First, because so far, he described the insurgency as a series of little groups with no national strategy. So after all, there is a national strategy. And second, doesn't answer really the problem. Because next year, you're going to have huge pressure in the south and the north, and we don't have the troops just to contain the Taliban. So again, yes, I think they are clever. I mean, basically, the U.S. military is the best trained, intellectually speaking, also on the ground, but intellectually speaking, is the best military in the world. But I think they are too big to understand, you know, in a way. When you have this level of bureaucracy, this level of of internal managing to do. Not always conflict, really, but, you know, nothing is moving really in the quickly. Plus, they are basically, they have decided to stay the course in the south instead of saying, okay, Helmand is a bad bet, let's work in Kabul. Where it could have worked in Kabul. A search around Kabul could have worked. You could have a much better security in Kabul with 30,000 troops around Kabul. You had the population was much more reticent to the insurgency. It was possible to make huge security gains, and it would have been very psychologically very important. Yeah. So I think you are first a big mistake. It's the South, and when you are in the South, you can try counterintelligence networking. Then the next step, you're fighting a classical war, search and destroy. It's Vietnam. In the south, it's Vietnam.
On that note, I'm sorry. I think we've more than run out of time. Thank you, Gilles, very much.
Thank you.
That gives us all depressing food for thought. Thank you.